Amy Barrett is probably a beneficiary from the Kavanaugh hearings. It blew up in their face. The American people hated what they did to Kavanaugh, so I think they were more respectful to Judge Barrett. But let me just say this. The internet is on fire tonight, pal. They are raising money like crazy to take back the Senate and beat President Trump. Help me help everybody I just named, lindseygraham.com. These people want it, man. My opponents raised $109 million, the most in the history of the United States Senate. Let's all fight back together, but let's celebrate tonight.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham on Fox News last night taking a victory lap after the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett while also begging for money. Graham is locked in a tight re-election battle in South Carolina with his Democratic challenger, Jamie Harrison. Real Clear Politics says the race is now a toss-up. Graham won it by nearly 16 points when he was last up for re-election. Around the country, states we never would have dreamed of being battlegrounds are now in the mix. In deep red Georgia, polls show Biden and Trump are basically tied.
I love Georgia. I love being with you. This is Georgia. This is Macon, Georgia. We won Macon, Georgia. We're going to win it again. It's great to be back in the heart of this incredible state with the thousands of loyal, hardworking, unbelievable American patriots. Thank you very much.
Well, even Texas is wobbling. Here's Jill Biden stumping for her husband in El Paso recently.
For the first time in a long time, winning Texas is possible.
Yeah.
Not just for Joe, but for the Senate and the State House as well. And if we win here, we are unstoppable.
Yeah.
Arizona, once arch-conservative Barry Goldwater country, is trending for Joe Biden now. The state could also see a pair of Democrats in the Senate for the first time in 70 years if astronaut Mark Kelly defeats incumbent Martha McSally.
And if you believe that we need to protect our kids from being shot in their classrooms, and you want to make communities safer from gun violence, be part of this mission.
Kelly's wife is former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was shot and killed in a campaign event back, nearly killed in a campaign event in 2011. She was seriously wounded. In the presidential contest, a CNBC poll out today shows Biden with an 11-point lead over President Trump. However, Democrats are wary of all this polling because, well, this time in 2016, an ABC News poll had Hillary Clinton also leading by double digits. You could argue pollsters were right. She did win the popular vote, but they missed a lot, too, like last-minute voters who went for Trump in swing states. Of course, there are uncertainties this year as well. It's hard to say how the pandemic will affect the turnout. But one of the glaring flaws revealed 4 years ago was that pollsters relied too heavily on the college-educated voter, often supporters of Hillary Clinton's, and they didn't adjust for the less educated voter who turned out for Trump. Joining us to talk about how the presidential polling system changed in the last 4 years is Sue Halpern, staff writer at The New Yorker. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, in all your research, what are pollsters doing differently this year than they did in 2016?
So you just mentioned that they missed the boat when they were doing their modeling and they decided to, you know, give a little more weight to college-educated folks and less so to people who weren't college-educated. So one of the things that tends to happen with polling is that the next time around, when they're doing their modeling, they take into account what they missed the last time. So no doubt this time, you know, they're going to give more weight to people who didn't go to college, less weight to people who did go to college. And, you know, it might not turn out to be correct this time. So they're always, an election behind when they're doing their modeling. Basically, you know, polls are their best guess at who is going to turn out. And then within that best guess of who's going to turn out, then they give different weights to different cohorts. So it's a bit of a crapshoot. They call it science. But there's an art to it as well, and that art can be very subjective.
Well, focusing on the battleground states, Hillary Clinton, well, as we said, she won the national vote by about 3 million votes, but it was just the around a little less than 80,000 or so votes in these basically three key states that cost her the election. So are pollsters looking at those states, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and others more closely now and fine-tuning their approach in the battleground states?
Yeah, they are. But, you know, what's really interesting is that this time around, the cohort that they might be missing is the youth vote. So historically, young people, that's, you know, 18 to 34-year-olds, don't really vote very frequently. But this time they are. And so if the pollsters miss that, then they're going to miss, you know, yet a different section of the population when they're looking at these battleground states. And it's kind of crucial. Like in Pennsylvania, already a quarter of a million young people have voted. A lot of those people didn't vote, you know, in the last time around. So that's kind of interesting. Same thing in Texas. So, you know, we don't really know. And that's kind of an interesting place to be. And same, like, in the battleground states like Michigan or Wisconsin, we don't really know what women are going to do. So, you know, they were really crucial for Trump. You know, white suburban women were crucial for Trump last time around. But we don't know what's happened in those 4 years to those women. And so that's going to be a really interesting demographic to take a look at at the end.
But we saw what happened in 2018 in the midterms. And suburban women turned out, and they turned out, and when you look at a state like Michigan, really turned out in favor of the Democrats and helped bring a blue, basically, tsunami to Michigan. I mean, the
right.
whole state seemed to go blue in the midterms. So could pollsters look at that and say, well, okay, we're looking at that 2 years later, we still see suburban women trending Democratic?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, like I said, it depends on what they decide, who the likely voters are. That's sort of the very beginning of what they're doing. And it's just, it's really unclear. And, you know, remember, top of the ticket versus, you know, down ballot is also a little different. One of the things that happened in 2016 was there's a very concerted effort on the part of the Republicans to get people of color in places like Detroit not to vote top of the ticket. So you saw this disparity between, you know, there were a lot of people voting down ballot and voting Democratic, but not voting for either Trump or for Clinton. So, you know, it's so much of polling is this idea that the pollsters kind of know, can predict who's going to vote, and we just really, you know, it's a best guess.
And are their methods different now, given that there is social media and people are expressing themselves quite vociferously and frequently on social media platforms? Is that a better way to judge who's going to vote for whom?
I think that what pollsters would say is that the kind of analysis that can be done on social media, which is being done, it's called sentiment analysis, is a good ancillary way of sort of seeing how they're doing and also, you know, getting a different view. But remember, like, not that many people use Twitter, for instance. So if you were doing only sentiment analysis on Twitter, you might only have a skewed idea of, you know, what people are actually saying. And also they tend to be more, it tends to be Democrats who are on Twitter, not obviously exclusively, but more. So I think that people are using some of the newer technologies, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, to sift through social media posts, to do large-scale online surveying, and use that to kind of complement whatever else they're doing that's more traditional polling. So far, none of that has kind of replaced traditional polling, but it's possible that ultimately that will be true, and that'll be really an interesting place to be.
Yeah. And what about what's happening now with this incredible rise in COVID cases in the Midwest? Is that affecting the polls at all? Can you tell?
We don't know, because right now polls are, they're time sensitive. So any polls that we're seeing now were probably taken, a week or two ago. So anything that's happening now in terms of a surge, we might not actually see until, very, very close to the election. What we do know is that the idea that vote by mail, is somehow more likely to end up, being fraudulent or whatever those, that those talking points are, has really inspired a lot of people to show up and vote in person and take the risk. We see these incredibly long lines, even, in your state, and really all over the country, people are just deciding that it's, that democracy is worth the risk of getting sick.
So given everything you just said about how polls are, imperfect, when we're looking at the polls, and I think a lot of us are really, maybe obsessed with them against our better judgment, should we be looking at them with a big grain of salt and think, well, it could go either way? Or do you think that there is enough evidence on one side or the other to say pretty confidently that Joe Biden is ahead in the presidential race or not?
So that's such an interesting question. And, obviously it's the one that a lot of people are banking on, so I would say two things. One is we know and we learned really very seriously in 2016 that national polls aren't really that helpful, because that's not how presidents are selected. They're selected through the Electoral College. So looking at battleground states is a much better way to assess, how candidates are doing. And there are trackers. Real Clear Politics is a website, and they have battleground state trackers. And so that's, one thing to look at. But the thing that I learned that I found really fascinating and also a little discouraging, when you look at a poll, it always says, the margin of error is, three points or something like that. Well, the people who actually know about, how you put polls together have told me that the margin of error is often incomplete, that there are things that just can't show up in that margin of error. And so their rule of thumb is to double the margin of error. So if you see a margin of error that says 3, just double it to 6, and then look at that and decide, when you look at that, when you say doubling the margin of error, almost invariably all these polls just get closer and closer and closer. Mm-hmm. Then they look, I heard today, it was a poll, I think it was Texas, it was Biden was up by 3, but no, there was another poll, Trump was up by 4. And in my mind, basically what they were saying is, it's a toss-up. So just be wary when you're looking at polls.
Okay. Buyer beware. Sue Halpern exactly. From The New Yorker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, this is our final day, so count yourself in at kcrw.com/give. This is it, procrastinators. This is your last chance to become a member during this drive, so now is the time to do it. kcrw.com/give. Tons of great thank you gifts there. Pick up a hoodie, pick up a mask, a KCRW mask. But, we're talking about voting. This is the way you vote for what you believe in, by going online at kcrw.com/give. Coming up, how one tree in Chile provides the key ingredient to one of the possible COVID vaccines. We'll have that fascinating story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The COVID vaccine, we all want to know when it's going to be available. And will we be able to get one? Will it work? most crucially. Less discussed, but very important, what will actually be in this vaccine? One common ingredient in vaccines are something called adjuvants. They're substances that help fire up your immune system. But they often come from obscure places, like the soap bark tree. It grows in only one country, Chile. The tree's particular adjuvant is an important ingredient in one of the leading vaccines in the government's Operation Warp Speed. We're going to talk about this now with two people. Ricardo San Martin is a researcher who helped develop the soap bark industry in Chile, and he's also a lecturer at UC Berkeley. And Brendan Burrell, who wrote an article about this tree and its role in vaccines for The Atlantic. Brendan, let's begin with you and just explain for us what exactly is an adjuvant. What do they do in vaccines?
Yeah, so an adjuvant is like a booster to a vaccine. And whereas the vaccine itself contains something that scientists call an antigen, which in the case of the coronavirus is the spike protein we've heard so much about, that's the thing that your body learns to respond to. The thing is, if you just deliver the spike protein by itself, your body actually doesn't notice it's there, and it doesn't remember it. And so you need this extra little booster, which is the adjuvant, to wake up your immune system.
And do these adjuvants, are they usually made in a lab, or are they found in nature?
Most of the ones that we know are natural compounds. Some of them are like a piece of a bacteria or a chemical like the one we're talking about today that comes from a tree. And it turns out that our immune systems have sort of this very primitive way of recognizing an invader. They have this really this danger switch, basically. They get switched on by certain types of motifs that bacteria tend to have. And so there's all these natural compounds that might actually activate that switch as well. And that's what an adjuvant is.
Okay, so let's talk about the adjuvant that comes from the Chilean soap bark tree. And this company, Novavax, is using it in its COVID vaccine. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there's a tree down in Chile that the bark of the tree has long been known as sort of containing this soapy substance. The indigenous people down there would use it to wash their clothes and their hair. And it turns out that it also has some sort of immune-stimulating properties. And so people started to notice this in the 1950s, basically, and they tested it out in veterinary vaccines. But it was, like, super reactive, and that's the sort of the flip side of an adjuvant, is it can cause a too strong of an immune response. And so it never was really applied to humans until about 20 years ago, when scientists started looking for individual compounds that were sort of the optimal level of stimulation. And they came up with one, and that one eventually got approved in the shingles vaccine, which is incredibly effective.
And Ricardo, how did you discover the usefulness of the Chilean soap bark tree when it comes to adjuvants?
That's the way I started my research. I work with scientists that were the ones that initiated the science behind Novavax. And so they were very interested in making collaborations with someone based in Chile, like I was at that time. So they introduced me to the topic, and I was searching all over Chile to see what trees could have these compounds and what trees may not.
Why is it that it's only this particular tree that has the compound?
Well, that's nature, you know, that's the way nature works. Even in that particular tree, there are many compounds closely related, but just this single tree has the right compound.
And it only grows in Chile?
It grows on, it's native of Chile, but it can grow here in California too.
And is it growing here in California?
Well, people use it ornamentally. And there you can find them in the botanical gardens. You can find it around Berkeley and Santa Barbara, San Diego. You can find them, but in the streets, in some houses, no one is planting this for a commercial reason.
Well, so Brendan, is there a problem here that there's a limited supply of these trees and a global demand for this vaccine? Should this vaccine get approved?
I mean, that's one of the big questions that Ricardo's looked into. And I think that it comes down to sort of two issues. Number one is, are there enough of these trees? And specifically, you know, trees have different levels of this compound in it. And so in Chile, it's a question of, are there enough of the trees that have that high levels of that compound that you can commercially extract it? And then the other thing is the main company that's obtaining this compound, you know, one of the questions that they had this year was, can they ramp up the harvest and extraction of this fast enough to meet the needs of a worldwide vaccine? And what if we end up with two or three other vaccines against other diseases? And kind of down the line, how is that going to threaten the tree? And are we going to be able to keep up the supply? And I think that's what Ricardo is working so hard to try to solve.
So what are some ideas, Ricardo, for ramping up the supply of this adjuvant from the tree?
Well, we have found that small trees, when I mean small, we're talking about trees between 1 and 3 years old, do have these compounds, not only in the bark as the old trees that are used today, but it also, they have it in the leaves. And we have found some trees that are very interesting because they have very high levels of the compounds we are looking for. So the idea is to plant them and harvest them at 2 or 3 years and get it from there, not from 30-year-old trees as it's done today.
But still, 2 to 3 years from when? From now?
But, yeah, 2-3 years from now. But what I mean, today there's enough trees down in Chile to ramp up the production and meet the demand for the next 3-5 years. The thing is, what happens next? You see, it's not for the immediate use. That will be met with the production that is done in Chile, but immediately we may find surprise and we may have the compounds, I mean, commercially available in a year from small trees. But I don't want to be so optimistic. I know that 2 or 3 years, it's good.
But you're planting the trees in California and in Chile, the new trees?
They're planted in Chile, and the reason they were planted in Chile 8 years ago was because they're also in the shingles vaccine. So they're planted there. And now we need more. So we are looking at other sites of plantation, like here in California.
And Brendan, Novavax obviously is not the only company that's trying to develop a COVID vaccine. There's also Pfizer, Moderna, for example. They use a different adjuvant?
Each of these vaccines, they have different technologies. So the type of vaccine that Novavax has, it's basically would not work or would barely work without an adjuvant. Turns out that Pfizer and Moderna, these are the two leaders in the vaccine race we're looking at. They have this cutting-edge technology called messenger RNA. So rather than delivering that spike protein, it delivers the genetic instructions for the protein. And it turns out that this RNA, this genetic material, has an adjuvant-like property. And then in addition to that, that material is packaged in a little bit of a fat that can stimulate the immune system. So they don't necessarily need a separate adjuvant like the soap bark. But we have other vaccines like Sanofi's vaccine, which they are using a different type of adjuvant that comes from, it's derived from shark livers, actually.
Shark livers?
That's right, yeah. So it's an oil-like substance, you know, and some conservationists have raised some alarm about that. But it seems like that adjuvant we have enough of a supply for. It's already stockpiled at a federal level. But people actually don't think that's as effective as this QS21. This QS21 is just about the most effective.
And that only comes from the Chilean soap bark tree. But it sounds like with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines or possible vaccines, that they may have an advantage because they don't need this adjuvant.
Right. I mean, that definitely is, you know, it's both an advantage and a potential disadvantage. One of the issues is with the RNA-based vaccines is they have to be kept at very, very cold temperatures, actually like negative 20 or negative 80 degree freezers, which, you know, is pretty hard to come by, especially in rural areas or in poorer countries. And so many people see the Novavax's vaccine as this is the vaccine that's going to save the world. This is the one that you can store it at refrigerator temperatures. And so there's kind of pros and cons with each approach. RNA is very fast, not as easy to distribute. the Novavax vaccine might be more broadly distributed.
And you're writing a book on the race for a COVID vaccine. What do you think? When will there be an effective one available?
Well, everything we're hearing from the scientists, I mean, what we've seen with the preliminary data so far has been so promising that that a lot of people expect these first two vaccines out of the gate from Moderna and Pfizer to actually be safe and effective. I mean, we're still waiting for these phase three trials to release their interim data and to be certain. But everybody's optimistic that we're going to have, you know, evidence that they work by, you know, middle of November. And as Dr. Fauci has said, that you know, by the middle of next year, most of people in the U.S. will be able to get a vaccine if they want one. So we're still looking at, you know, 8 months till that happens. But things are looking really good.
Ricardo, are you as optimistic?
Yes, I am. But Brenda touched on very important points about the distribution for the rest of the world, the kind of vaccines the rest of the world needs and the refrigeration aspects. So yes, I'm optimistic, and I'm very optimistic also for the approach of Novavax. I mean, that approach is quite solid. So I'm sure there are going to be quite a few vaccines. In the U.S., probably people will get it first, but other countries will probably get a different kind of vaccine later.
How will we know which vaccine is the most effective to take if there are multiple candidates?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we will see what the data is, and we'll hear if one might be more effective in certain populations than others. For instance, we know that vaccines don't work as well on the elderly, and that's actually one area where this adjuvant is very helpful because it boosts that immune response among the elderly, and we know that from the shingles vaccine, which was incredibly effective in the older population. So far, Pfizer and Moderna both say that their vaccines work well in the elderly, and I think we'll just have to see. We don't know until it's fully been tested and vetted, and so I think everybody's watching that.
All right, fingers crossed for sure. Brendan Burrell is a writer in Los Angeles. You can read his article on the soap bark tree and vaccines in The Atlantic. And Ricardo San Martin is a lecturer at UC Berkeley, and he helped develop the soap bark industry in Chile. Thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, this is it, you procrastinators out there. This is the final, final, final day of our Count Yourselves In membership drive. So do it now. If you're not in, come on in. If you are in and you need to renew, now is the time. And if you just did all this, maybe in the last drive and you're thinking, hey, I think I could donate a little bit more because this is how much KCRW means to me, then certainly we would love to have your added donation. It all happens at kcrw.com/give. Lots of great thank you gifts there, including a meditation app. So you might want that, given how stressful life is these days. All right. Coming up, how COVID is changing the centerpiece of the Thanksgiving table.
You know, we've had 50 years of steadily increasing turkey consumption. This may be kind of an inflection point.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanksgiving is right around the corner, and people are rethinking their usual plans, of course, choosing to stay home instead of traveling to attend a big family gathering, which means most families don't need that gigantic turkey in the middle of the table. And that means this is tough times for farmers who grow these turkeys. And we're going to talk about that now with Laura Riley. She covers food business for The Washington Post. Hi.
Thanks for having me today.
Great to have you. Well, what are these turkey farmers telling you? Are they freaking out?
They're freaking out. So they had to make these decisions months and months ago, especially for the heritage breed birds that grow really slowly. They had to decide this stuff. You know, a lot of them have to decide on their poults, those are the babies, a year in advance. So This is completely pre-pandemic. But then even just how many to grow out, the speed, the feed, all of that kind of stuff had to be decided before we knew how long this was going to go on. So the issue really is that for Thanksgiving, most of us want maybe a 16 to 18 pound bird, maybe even a little smaller than that. Those are the females. Those are the, mm-hmm. the hens. And for food service, for like deli, turkey breast, that kind of thing, those are the toms. Those are the over 20 pound male birds. So for a mm-hmm. lot of the turkey farmers, they had to kind of make their gender split decision really early in this. And a lot of them are saying, geez, we may not have enough small birds and may have too many big birds.
Oh, so too many tom turkeys roaming around.
Exactly.
What are they going to do with them?
Well, you can't just harvest them. I've innocently said, well, why can't you just slaughter them a little young? And they said, no, these birds, they don't pack meat on. They look kind of scrawny and funny looking if you just harvest a tom turkey early. So, you know, also it's a completely different market. So there's the kind of butterball frozen commodity turkey route, and then there's the heritage breed fresh turkey. You can't just harvest, you know, there are a lot of different money involved in different supply chains. So for a fresh turkey producer, you earn a fraction of the money if you freeze those birds and sell them as frozen birds. So it's not a function of just, you know, pivoting to a frozen product. So they're going to do the best they can. They're going to hope that maybe, you know, they can freeze their toms for future use and sell all of the smaller turkeys they can. And then there are all these other markets that have dried up. I mean, if you think about where people eat turkey legs, it's Renaissance fairs, you know, sporting events, state fairs, you know, theme parks, all these things that just didn't take place this summer. So somewhere there's a mountain of turkey legs waiting to be utilized. A horrible image, but
yeah. So a mountain of turkey legs in some freezer somewhere. But yeah. I guess they're just going to have to slaughter a bunch of these turkeys and just, what, bury the carcasses?
Well, hope for the best. I mean, they may harvest the toms and freeze them. You know, there are some other issues. So retailers are saying, well, if most American families are saying they're going to have immediate family-only gatherings, that's going to mean a lot of people who've never hosted a Thanksgiving are going to host a Thanksgiving. So, you know, I don't mean just people in their 20s, but like people who always go to grandma's house and who've never done it themselves. So that's going to augur for other things. So people who are unfamiliar with how to cook a turkey feel a little intimidated. They may make a roast. They may pick seafood. They may do something else entirely. And then you have the rise of plant-based meat that's really been kind of jet-propelled by the pandemic. And there are going to be a lot more households who do something that's meat-free or mm-hmm. where that is an alternative.
And maybe they'll never go back. Maybe this will be the start of something entirely new.
Well, turkey farmers don't want to hear that, but I think that a lot of the people I spoke with for this story said, you know, we've had 50 years of steadily increasing turkey consumption, and that this may be kind of an inflection point.
Hmm. Well, meanwhile, that doesn't help the turkey farmers. So are they in a tough place financially?
Well, so some of the turkey farmers, especially the larger ones, were eligible for CFAP money, for the pandemic kind of farmer relief money. So some of them have received that and have been, you know, propped up a little bit, like a lot of the other poultry, beef, pork. Those industries have been propped up in recent months. So some of them will be made whole by that. A lot of them are assuming they'll sell out of their small birds and kind of muddle through with the bigger birds, because as we know, like very few of us are going to be some of us have the tradition of going out to restaurants, but very few of us this year will be going and sitting in a restaurant to have a Thanksgiving buffet, say.
Okay, but there is also the idea that come next year, there'll be all this pent-up demand and people are going to want to go crazy, have a million people over and have a huge celebration and bring back the gigantic turkey.
Let's hope. I mean, it'll be like Norman Rockwell all over the country next year, right? We'll all want those, like, you know, multi-generational table that seats 20 kind of things. Let's hope, you know, that that's where we are. But, you know, the turkey farmers have to make these decisions so far in advance. There may not be a vaccine that we know of that will have widespread use before they have to make the next decision.
Laura Riley covers food for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now is the time to get online at kcrw.com/join and become a member, renew your membership, whatever it takes. You know, these are definitely anxious times and we're all feeling it. I know I'm grinding my teeth. I can tell every morning my jaw is, ouch, it is hurting. So if you're in that same boat, you know that we're here for you day in and day out. Maybe KCRW provides you with a welcome respite and also insight into what's happening in your world. And know that we are all in this together and we need you now more than ever. We need you to be part of it. So you can do that at any amount. Any amount gets you in. KCRW.com/join. And maybe you have the means to help where someone else doesn't and donate for them. KCRW.com/join. Joining me now is Steve Chiotakis with a preview of Greater LA. Hi.
I'm going to throw in a few dollars for a mouth guard for your grinding teeth because that sounds dangerous, right?
You.
Be careful with
Thank
that.
You.
My goodness.
Thank you. I think we're all
but
doing
it is
this.
Important. Today's the day. This we wrap it up. KCRW.com/give. Please, 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 if you haven't already, do so now. Today is the day. KCRW.com/give. Coming up, Madeline, on the show in just a few minutes, we're going to talk fires. Big fires in Orange County causing a lot of problems and a lot of people having to flee. So that's coming up.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Coming up, we'll tell you about some binge-worthy TV shows. So don't go anywhere. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. It is Tuesday, so that means time for TV on the radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh, my God! They've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, are you tired of watching all of those shows over and over again? And maybe old Friends reruns? We know you're doing that. No judgment. Well, there are many more binge-worthy shows out there. We have three brand new shows to discuss, plus a couple that have been out for a little bit but are worth going back to and looking at again. Jen Chaney is here with her picks. She's TV critic for Vulture. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So debuting a new show just before a massive history-making election is either a great or a terrible idea. What do you think? Which one?
Well, it could be a terrible idea in the sense that everyone's attentions are going to be distracted. On the other hand, I do think that some people will be purposely looking for distraction. And the funny thing to me is that I think many of us were under the impression that by this time, the entire TV pipeline was going to have dried up because of the pandemic and production shutting down in the spring. And honestly, that has yet to happen. I mean, there are fewer shows, admittedly, than there would have ordinarily been, but there is still a lot. And the good news is that there's still a lot of good stuff as well.
Okay, let's begin with The Good Lord Bird. This is on Showtime. It stars Ethan Hawke and David Diggs. Hawke plays abolitionist John Brown of the Harper's Ferry Raid, and Diggs plays Frederick Douglass. And here's a clip.
My name is Captain John Brown! And you are on the side of change!
Oh my gosh. He's very shouty. Is he good too?
This is just an extraordinary performance from Ethan Hawke. You know, John Brown, a famous abolitionist, has often been portrayed in history as being a kook, basically, just kind of a crazy guy. Obviously, he was very much on the right side of history in that he was very much against slavery and took action about it. But what the show does is it shows his absurdity, but it also shows his humanity. He's such a complicated and interesting character. And Ethan Hawke isn't constantly shouting when he's playing him, but he does have those very intense kinds of moments like you just heard. I mean, I think Ethan Hawke is a great actor, but this might be the best performance of his entire career. But what's interesting about this show is that as the book that it was based on, it's through the point of view of a young Black boy who is mistaken by John Brown for being a girl, and he never quite figures out that it's actually a boy, and he nicknames the boy Onion. And Onion is played by Joshua Caleb Johnson, and he is, you know, does a great job in this, and he's never really done anything before. But the thing that's interesting about this show is that there is this current of dark humor that runs through it that I thought would be a really tricky thing to balance in a show that's about slavery, but it works really, really well. I thought this was just a really excellent, excellent drama.
And we have to note that it is based on the novel by James McBride, who definitely has a very wry streak in his writing. He's known for that acerbic and funny take, and also really interesting, deep takes on race and what it's like, you know, to live in a multicultural society. So did he have a strong hand in this, in the TV show?
He is one of the executive producers. It was actually, the show was created by Ethan Hawke and Mark Richard, but I think they consulted pretty closely with James McBride. So that tone that you're describing is very present in the show.
Okay, next up, The Queen's Gambit, another limited series, and it's on Netflix. It's also based on a book. It's a show about an orphan female chess prodigy who struggles with addiction. Here's a clip.
Tell the readers of life how it feels and to be a girl among all those men.
I don't mind it. Chess isn't always competitive. Chess can also be beautiful.
Is this based on a real person, or is it entirely made up?
It's based on a novel. It's a fictional tale. The novel came out quite some time ago, back in 1983. But as you said, it really follows this character, Beth Harmon, from the time that she's a little girl and is sent to an orphanage and really learns to play chess from the custodian, who happens to play chess every day in the basement, and he decides to basically mentor her. And then it follows her into her adulthood as she becomes, you know, really the only woman in this field dominated by men, and constantly schooling them with her incredible, almost instinctive, innate skill at playing chess. And I know nothing about chess. I don't know how to play, but I still found this totally fascinating. And, you know, I think of chess as a slow sort of game, but they do a lot to make this very suspenseful and very exciting to watch.
Well, you can do it with the timers, and then it gets a little more exciting to watch.
Yes, that's right. The timers do make a big really difference.
And how is the lead actress, Anya Taylor-Joy?
Oh, well, she's fantastic. You may have seen her before, especially recently in the adaptation of Emma that came out in the spring. You know, she starts playing the role as a teenager, and you can just see her physically change and kind of blossom into a woman of more grace and more understanding. And as you mentioned earlier, she's also playing somebody who is addicted to pills and alcohol. And so that's a huge part of the story as well. But it's just a rich, big performance. And she has eyes the size of planets. And they're just such an amazing tool for her as an actress. She's someone to watch for sure.
Okay, moving on to our third limited series based on a book, The Undoing on HBO. This debuted on Sunday. It stars Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. Here's a clip.
The thrill of adultery is that it exists in the shadow.
We can lose ourselves sometimes, but it doesn't undo who we are.
People conceal the ugly truths.
Why were you there that night?
To protect themselves.
Okay, this was written by David E. Kelley, who also adapted Big Little Lies, which Kidman also starred in. Is this show very similar to that?
There are definitely elements in this show that will remind you of Big Little Lies, in that it's focused on the very wealthy within an elite private school. This is, of course, in Manhattan rather than in California, but it's also driven narratively by a murder that happens. And you don't know who committed the murder until I'm going to say until the end. I still haven't seen the last episode because HBO hasn't provided us with that. If they don't tell us who did it, I'm going to have a complete conniption fit, but I assume they will. but it's that idea that the mystery that really drives it, and how much Nicole Kidman's character, who's married to Hugh Grant, how much she hasn't really fully seen about her life and what's really going on around her. And you know, this is one, because it's on HBO, it's a week to week, so you have to wait a whole week to get the next episode. Had it been available to binge right away, I think people would have just blown through it in a night, because it's that kind of show where at the end of each episode, you're like, oh my gosh, I have to see what happens next.
I did find myself wondering why HBO does this to us. Why haven't they caught the Netflix bug?
Well, I don't know. I think there's something to be said for that waiting of a week. I think that as a society, we've become way too accustomed to instant gratification. And I think, you know, you look at some of the shows that HBO has had, and this was especially true of Game of Thrones. If Game of Thrones had been something you could watch, you know, initially all in one gulp, I don't think it would have been the cultural phenomenon it was, because we had to wait a week and we had to talk about the episode and have that moment of anticipation. I think that made it into more of a phenomenon.
But we were also going to the office back then, or at least most more of us were than we are now.
That is true.
We have got a lot of time at home to be binging. All right, let's talk about Hulu's Pen 15, the second season. It's been out for a while, since mid-September. But for those who haven't seen it, the two main actresses play middle school versions of themselves. And here's a clip from season two.
When you're not around, I go through your underwear drawer and try on every pair with flowers on them.
Over or under yours?
Under.
So how is season two? Is it more the same, or does it chart new territory?
I think it charts a little bit of new territory. You know, the first season was very funny and really well observed, but I think this season goes into some deeper emotional territory for the two main characters, Maya and Anna, who are played by Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, who created the series. You know, that time in your life when you're 12 years old is just such an emotionally intense and fraught time. And they just capture that so, so well. And I have to say, every time I watch the show, I mean, these are women in their early 30s playing 12-year-olds while being surrounded by actual 12-year-olds, which is just a ridiculous idea. I forget how old they are every single time I start watching this, and because they're so good, and they and these shows are so well written. I think it's one of the best coming of age stories that you can be watching right now.
When they're filming some of the, let's say, more coming of age scenes, they're not filming those scenes with actual 13-year-olds, are they?
They find ways to sort of work around anything that would be inappropriate. Let me just put it that way. But certainly there are scenes that are more like emotionally intense where, you know, like a young boy has to tell Maya Erskine's character that she's ugly and horrible and he doesn't like her. And I actually interviewed them recently. We were talking about that and how they you know, kind of talk these younger actors through these situations, which some of them may be experiencing in their own lives, for that matter.
All right, moving on to a show that's been critically well received. It's been out for a little bit. It's called I May Destroy You on HBO. And it's about a writer in London who goes out to party one night. She is sexually assaulted, and then she tries to figure out what happened because she had been slipped a drug, and so she doesn't really remember in the immediate aftermath. Here's a clip from I May Destroy You.
We see you, Bob. And if we see you, it means we are right there with you, tiptoeing in line, right behind you. And in that place, where rules, clarity, law, and separation cease to exist, we will show you exactly what we mean by violation.
Well, this series, this storyline is based on the true story of the star and writer, Michaela Cole. This really happened to her. It's obviously a very serious and intense subject matter, but it can also be funny, this show, and just super energetic. What do you think of it?
This is just a terrific show. And it really takes that. There's, again, this is a mystery element, right, where she isn't sure who actually raped her. And so you're kind of waiting for her to put the pieces together and figure it out. But it's also about so many other things. It's about how, you know, she really kind of claims her power over this and talks about the fact that she's been assaulted and raped and what that does as far as her public persona on social media. And it also explores these similar kinds of issues about sexual boundaries involving some of her friends on the show. And I thought the finale was one of the most kind of mind-blowing, thought-provoking last episodes of a show that I've seen all year. So this is definitely one, if you missed it, it's an HBO show, go back and catch up with it.
And you don't have to wait, you can binge it now because it's all out.
That is correct. You don't need to be patient, it's all there for you.
Good, that's how I like it. Jen Chaney, TV critic for Vulture, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, here's some immediate gratification for you. You can instantly pretty much instantly become a member or renew your membership by going online at kcrw.com/join. It'll make you feel really great, and it'll make us feel really great. We can't do this without you. I keep saying this over and over again, but it really is true. We are supported by you now more than ever. During this pandemic, a lot of our corporate support has dried up, as it has with lots of media organizations. So we really do rely on you a lot more for our basic day-to-day operations. So now is the time to do it. It's our very last day for our membership drive. So don't wait any longer. It's really, really important that you get in on this right now, because as we've seen, we don't know when this whole thing is going to end, when we're going to get out of this economic slump. And so we need to keep going forward, and we need to be here for you. So be there for us, please. And thank you so, so very much. If you've already donated, or you've upped your membership, or you've renewed, we just treasure you so much. Really do. We are one big family. We're getting bigger, and that's thanks to you. KCRW.com/join. Lots of great thank you gifts there, so go check it out. Great new hoodies, sweatshirts, all that stuff. KCRW.com/join. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for being a listener. Thanks for being a donor. I'll see you tomorrow.